Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A little different show today. Instead of one veteran sharing his experiences over the course of 1 hour together, we're hearing from three different vets who will all be on one big charter plane with Central Valley Honor Flight this coming week. Again, the Honor Flight Network has an active hub in every area where this program is heard. If you have a World War II vet in your life who has not been to the National World War II Memorial, sign him up or sign her up. I have links for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find some photos of Wayne Thompson, who completed 30 missions with the 379th Bomb Group as a radar navigator bombardier. He'll finally get to visit the National World War II Memorial and see a wall of gold stars signifying the more than 406,000 Americans who never came home from that war.
Is that something you ever thought about? Did you think, you know what, maybe this mission is my last mission?
Towards the end, I got that way. And I said, man, I hope this one's going to be another good one.
Was it because you knew you were getting close to that number where you'd be able to come home?
Yeah, I think so.
And you had a wife waiting at home.
Right.
And by this time, did you know that she was expecting?
Yes. And in fact, my number one son was born while I was over in England. And I got a telegram on March 1st, 45, saying, you're the proud father of a baby boy. So
that's a pretty big incentive to get home, isn't it?
Yes. The captain congratulated me on my 30 missions, and he said, Lieutenant Thompson, yes, sir, how'd you like to be a captain? Well, sir, what's that mean? You know, what do I have to do? And he shoved a piece of paper at me and said, well, you can sign this piece of paper. I said, well, what am I signing, sir? Well, you signed permission for another tour, and I'll give you your captain bars right now. And I said, thank you, sir, but no thanks.
So it was a choice between coming home to a wife and a son you've never met or flying more missions in Europe. Tough call. So when did you get home, and what did that feel like?
It was great. My wife met me in Pittsburgh, which isn't – Pittsburgh was about 60 miles from Sharon, Pennsylvania. I came in by, train into Pittsburgh, and it was a great – what a meeting.
Had you even seen a picture of your baby boy?
No, had not.
You had the telegram. You knew he was born on March 1st.
Yeah.
What was that like to see a child for the first time?
It was just overwhelming, Paul. It just, the emotions that time, probably, I can't remember exactly, but I know how lucky I was to get home and see my son and my wife. And, you know, when I was at Langley Field, getting ready to leave, to go overseas, I met my wife at the airfield, and we said goodbye. And I said, I must be really dumb. Here you are, you're pregnant. I'm going overseas. I don't know where I'm coming back. But it worked out.
Something tells me she was saying a few prayers for you while you were over there.
Yeah, yes, she was.
And you got a few letters from her, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I know you miss her very much. And, Wayne, I know that that all your family is certainly thankful for what you did during the war. And on behalf of our audience, I want to thank you for serving and for being willing to share with us about it. And there's one more thing you did when you came back that's kind of an interesting twist to all this. We talked about how you wanted to be a pilot, but when they found out you were colorblind and said no more, you became a pilot after all.
Yeah. Real quickly, Paul, I found out I could get my private pilot's license, and I said, well, what about being colorblind? They said, oh, that's not a problem. I said, what we'll do, we'll take you out onto the tarmac, and the tire will shoot colored light guns at you, and they'll flash the light. I said, if you can tell red, green, and blue, and white, you're a pilot. So I did, and I got my private license.
So he does know what it's like to be in the cockpit, but he's more than happy to be a passenger on next week's Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C., and there will be plenty of other pilots on board, like 92-year-old Bob Stoneham of Mariposa, California, the son of a Spanish-American War veteran. Bob headed overseas in July of 1944, not knowing what twin-engine plane he'd be flying once he arrived in England. He found out it would be the B-26 Marauder, a plane he had never flown in training stateside, and unfortunately, he had heard some of the B-26's nicknames.
The flying prostitute, for example, mm-hmm. No visible means of support, the Widowmaker.
The Martin
heard
Murderer.
About the training in Florida, a plane a day in Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm. That can't be very encouraging. That's not the kind of reputation an aircraft wants to carry.
It was a good airplane. Don't knock it.
Well, you're here. So that's proof enough for me, but I'm just trying to, again, put myself in your shoes. And that's not what you want to hear about the plane that you're going to be flying. But I imagine you took to it fairly quickly, got accustomed to it.
Very easy, right.
What did you like about the B-26? I know it was designed to be a little faster than the B-25, for example.
It was heavy, and it felt like it would take the whatever they threw at us. And it did. We had some of the missions, we had a lot of flak. We had a lot of holes in the airplane. Had one mission where a shell went through the wing about 6 feet from me and happened to not explode, or I would not have been here today. Went on up above the plane and exploded above us. But it was a good airplane to be in, solid.
Those are the stories that fascinate me when you talk about close calls and how easily something could have been different. So the shell passed through?
Through the wing. When it came up, we were at about 13,000 feet, and mm-hmm. it was an aircraft from below. But the shell went through the wing. It didn't explode.
What did that sound like?
Oh, I never heard it. Didn't even know what happened.
It was
the first I knew, I looked up, and our wingman was looking down, and his eyes were about as big as saucers, and he was pointing. And then we didn't know that it happened until we got on the ground.
So he saw the shell come through and explode above you?
He saw it go through, yes.
Wow.
The missions were assigned by the headquarters based on requests most of the time from the ground troops. Like Patton, his army would ask for certain things to be done, and we would be assigned a marshalling yard where the trains were gathered. We would be assigned to mostly railroad bridges. In fact, the nickname of our group was the Bridge Busters at one time. And that was the type of thing that we did practically all the time.
Because of the B-26 and the firepower that you carried, at least that's your understanding, you didn't see a whole lot of fighter opposition from the Germans.
No. So we had a machine gun turret on the top of the aircraft. We had a tail gun turret. And we had fixed forward machine guns. We flew in tight formation. We flew in ship flight formations of six, very, very tight. And it was obvious that anyone that was attacking us was going to have a lot of 50 caliber machine gun fire coming their way. So we, at the time I was over there, we were never attacked by enemy fighters.
Well, and I know you're not complaining about that. No. You mentioned the machine guns, and as I understand it, you didn't fire those machine guns, at least on your plane, until your last mission?
Yeah, we had four fixed forward machine guns on the side of the aircraft, and on the last mission, which was right near the end of the war, and what I called a demoralization mission, they were trying to get the Germans to forget the whole thing and give up, mm-hmm. and we went in and bombed at 5,000 feet, which was about half our normal altitude, and then made a 180 and came back and machine gunned the village. I didn't see any people. We were shooting at buildings, so I didn't have a guilty conscience over it. It was just kind of a, here we go, whoopee, we're going to fire our guns for the first time.
I imagine there was some joking about that on the aircraft.
That's right.
You didn't know if they worked or not, probably.
Probably true.
So in the B-26, 12 missions, ever any time that the landing was a little hairy or you didn't know if you were going to make it down in one piece?
B-26 landings are always hairy.
Just by the nature
yeah,
of it,
Yeah, by
huh?
the nature, that's right. You're coming in at about 130, 120 miles an hour, and they were always hairy.
Jiggle your brain a little bit,
that's
huh?
That's right.
Bridge busters and brain busters. But I understand your scariest situation as far as landing a plane, and maybe the one that you look back, besides the shell going through your wing and say, wow, that could have ended up a lot different for me. You weren't even in a B-26, but an aircraft that was a little smaller with a little less firepower. Tell me about that.
Yeah, while we were stationed near Paris, one of our B-26s had received a shot through an engine and knocked out the oil cooler. And I was assigned to take an oil cooler in a little L5, a little fabric-covered Cub. They were used mostly as observation planes. But I was to fly this up to Luxembourg. I had a fellow with me. Lieutenant Coons was with me. But I had charge of the mission on the way up. We stopped at Reims, got some fuel, and on the way to Luxembourg, ran into a headwind that we had not anticipated. And when I got very near Luxembourg, the gas gauge showed empty. So I landed in a little pasture somewhere outside of Luxembourg.
Now, you're making this sound very matter-of-fact.
Yeah, it was not too hard. You could land in a pasture. Anyway, there was an anti-aircraft battalion, our side, next to the field and next to the pasture. We got 5 gallons of gas from them, put it in the plane, and frankly, we flipped a coin to see who was going to take it off. And whether I won or lost, I don't know. But I was sitting in the back seat. Don was in the front. And we started down the pasture and came to a sudden stop at the end because there was a little ditch there that we didn't clear. The plane stopped immediately. I got hit on the back of the head and neck with the oil cooler that was on the shelf behind me and knocked unconscious for a short period of time. First thing I knew was Don says, the plane's on fire, let's get out of here. So the undercarriage had been knocked out, so we were sitting on the ground. I set the oil cooler out, got out, and we stood off and watched it burn.
Well, and I want to take you back, just rewind a minute here. When you're talking about putting it down in the pasture, you said, yeah, no big deal. But when you're up in that L5 and you've got a headwind, were you basically standing still? Is that what it felt like?
Oh, no, it wasn't that bad. No, the only reason that I say we had a headwind is because we didn't have enough fuel to make our destination.
Mm-hmm. And had you probably hadn't been in that situation before, right? I mean, you hadn't been in a lot of L5s, but...
And I had never flown an L5 before, frankly.
Well, there's that, too. But so when you run out of gas and you're up in the air, you start looking for some place you can put it down.
That's the first thing you do in any training.
Mm-hmm.
From the time you start flying training in an airplane, you learn where you're going to land if something goes wrong. Primary flying school all the way through. Where am I going to put it down if the engine stops? So you're automatically thinking of that all the time.
And this was all friendly territory?
Yes, it had been already taken.
That helps. But how long did it take you to see this clearing? Were you looking at forest and finally here's a clearing?
No,
or did you see it right away?
Most of it was open land around there.
So that helps. That makes you feel a little better.
It was
easy.
That was not a problem.
I don't know if it was easy. I don't know if I'm buying you on that, but I'll take your word for it. So then you get knocked unconscious by this oil cooler, which was what you came there to bring to the B-26.
We did complete it. We got it out and took it on into them.
And then how'd you get out of there?
Somebody took us into town in a truck. And then how I got back out, I frankly can't remember whether somebody took us in a 6x6 back to Paris. And then right after we got back to Paris, we transferred into Belgium. So I was in one of those back of a 6x6 for a long time. It bothered my head and neck so much that I went into a hospital in Charleroi, Belgium, for a while.
So this was no fun for you. This
no,
wasn't
no,
good.
That
but
wasn't, that wasn't fun.
It sounds like it could have been a lot worse.
Could have been, sure. Anytime.
You were actually unconscious and woke up to find out you're on the inside of a burning plane.
Right.
And I'm amazed by how matter-of-fact this discussion is for you. I guess you've told the story a few times, but I don't know what I would do if I woke up in the middle of a burning plane.
You get out.
I guess so. And you completed your mission. You got that oil cooler to the B-26.
That's right.
When you think about the guys that you served with, what kind of characteristics did you appreciate in them? When you think back and you think about the kind of people that Americans were at that time, and servicemen and the pilots and crew members in the U.S. Army Air Corps, what did you most appreciate about them?
Everybody was dedicated in doing the job the best way they could. We had a job to do. We wanted to do it, finish it up, and come home. Everyone, the people at home, my oldest brother helped in the shipyards in the Bay Area building victory ships, and the brother next older than I was in the Navy in the South Pacific. We just wanted to get the job done and come home.
You ever think back and reflect on those close calls you had and wonder, could that have really been me? And why did I survive when someone else maybe did not?
That's another subject we're not going to get into. I presented a little program at our church one day, Why Am I Here?
Mm-hmm.
And I just rather not get in it because we get very religious then, and I don't want to do that.
I'm not trying to stop you from that. We've got a couple minutes left.
You wonder why you're here. Why am I still here?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason?
Mm-hmm.
Does God have some reason for going through these things and getting here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think you do know. And that's what I get from you, that you feel like God had a plan for you.
That's exactly right.
And it's kind of hard to argue with that when you look back at all the facts. Is there one thing, Bob, that you personally are most proud to have taken part in a particular mission or grander scheme of things kind of idea in the war in Europe that you look back on and that just really makes you feel good to have had a hand in it?
One thing that sticks in my mind is when we went into Munich in Army of Occupation, some of the guys from our group went to Dachau, mm-hmm. and they saw what had happened there, and they told about it. And frankly, I'm glad that I didn't go, but that's one of the reasons that we were there, and that's one of the reasons that we were successful is because we were dedicated in doing the job, finishing that thing up, and the things that were going on over there were just things that you don't want to talk about.
No, but it's so important that truth is not lost. Holocaust Remembrance Day is coming up on May the 5th this year. It's time for another break right now. We've heard from two men who will be enjoying a free flight to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial next week. Maybe you're one of those who donated to make it all possible. But also on that honor flight will be five brothers. And we'll hear from the oldest of that quintet when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly-and-buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.